It is a pleasure to introduce Dr. Dean Natastreet to address the topic of reaching out through the arts. Dean speaks to us with a wealth of experience, both in the parish setting and in creative writing for the worship setting. A graduate of both Concordia College Ann Arbor and Concordia Senior College, Dean Natastreet received his MDiv degree from this seminary in 1973, and in the same year an MA degree in political science from the University of Missouri-St. Louis. In 1996, Concordia College Seward awarded Dr. Natastreet with the honorary Doctor of Letters degree. Dean has served for over 20 years in the parish ministry. For 15 years, he served at Crossview Lutheran Church in Edina, Minnesota, a congregation in which God entrusted to his care over 1,200 members. Many of you are familiar with Dean's creative writing, having used his Bible studies, one of his several books, the most recent of which is Crossview's Story Dramas That Teach the Faith. Or you might have come across his work as a contributing writer for Concordia Pulpit, Concordia Pulpit Resources, Creative Worship, Concordia Journal, or now most recently Word, Witness, and Worship, published by CPH. With his extensive background in dramatic arts and literature, Dean capably holds the Greg H. Bennett Memorial Chair in Homiletics and Literature at this seminary. And so it is with pleasure that I introduce to you Dr. Dean Natastreet.
Well, it's fun to have a good friend do the introduction, and thank you, David, very much. What happened when I was in seventh grade at St. Martini Lutheran School? St. Martini, we used to joke it was across the street from Mount Olive Hospital. It wasn't, we just said that. But it was something we'd waited for a long time. We reached the seventh grade, and that meant Pastor Klein was going to take us on the tour of the sanctuary. We were now going to see all of the different symbols across the sanctuary that he could find, and he was going to interpret them for us. We went from stained glass window to stained glass window. We went to my grandmother's window, the one we always sat by, the one with the big eye inside the triangle. You know the one I'm talking about? What I remember about that window is whenever I was bad, my dad would just go. And that was enough to quiet me down. Anyway, it was there that Pastor Klein asked the question, which one of the omnis is represented here? And I thought real quickly, omni-sight? But Dennis, who always had it right, Dennis always had it right, and I'm worried about myself because I'm still angry that Dennis always had it right. He said, omniscience, Pastor. That means all-knowing. He even knew what it meant. And Pastor smiled. Pastor smiled, and Dennis smiled, and our teacher smiled. None of us smiled, but they all smiled. But inside my head, there began to be an understanding of how important image is to word. As he walked us through the sanctuary, nuances were shared, fine points of art. We came to the statue of Christ that stood over at the altar in that great old church, a life-size statue of Jesus Christ, one that I had loved for as long as I could remember. When I was in the fourth grade, they took that statue out for a few weeks to do some repair work and to give Jesus a good fresh coat of paint. I remember feeling empty inside when I worshiped in that church without the image of Christ where he belonged in front of us. Something of the mystery of icons is going on there that I don't fully understand. Now the statue was restored and looking, well, just like Jesus was supposed to look. Pastor asked if we noticed anything about the figure's hands, and I tried again and said, I see the nail prints in his hands. And Pastor got a look on his face that said, nice try again, Natastreet, but that really isn't right. Does anybody else notice anything? Dennis noticed. I really need to see Brian Salmonen about this because it's starting to worry me. He's welcoming us, Dennis said. His arms are welcoming us. And Pastor smiled, and Dennis smiled, and everybody else smiled. And I listened with intense interest as Pastor told us how the original sculptor had worked this particular piece. The original was by a man named Thorwaldsen. By the way, the copies of this are all over, not just the United States, but the world. He told of a clay prototype that Thorvaldsen had left in his studio, only it got so hot in the studio that the hands of Christ that were up like this in terms of almost an ascension posture came down like this to a welcoming posture. And it went from glory and blessing to invitation and summons. I'd not thought about that tour until I prepared for this presentation. But I see now that that was when I was first beginning to understand the interplay between image and theology. My childhood pastor preached sermons rich in doctrine, with language and abstract concepts far above my head. He was, to me, a man who was, as the proverb goes, invisible during the week and incomprehensible on Sundays. But now he stood before us, and he suddenly made such sense as he broke open image after image and tied to it conceptual frameworks that we'd been taught in confirmation class. I think I first began to love my pastor on this tour of the church. All those years later, I realized that when I load theological concepts in my preaching, I'm working with some of those same images. And certainly when I think of Jesus Christ as I present the gospel to my listeners, I picture Christ as that statue above the altar at St. Martini Lutheran Church. For many of you, I know you consider the arts to be ancillary to the word. Whether it be visual arts, drama, dance, poetry, or music, you would say that the arts supplement the word. I'm sure this view is motivated inside of you by a need to keep the word foremost and premier in your preaching and in your ministry. After all, you're not called to paint, except maybe men's bathrooms and things like that around your church. You're not called to direct theater, to play music, or to write poetry. You've been called to preach. Things can get out of whack, after all, if this arts thing gets carried to the extreme. For instance, how would you like to have been the pastor at the church in Leipzig where J.S. Bach was the musician? Anybody know that pastor's name? Can anybody quote a single line from his sermons? And will the historians please not put your hands up out there from the faculty? The arts can eclipse the word. Music and drama, if we're not careful, can turn our worship and even our sermons into performance centers, entertainment venues. But then I would like to ask you, do you really want to complain about the music of J.S. Bach? Much of it developed for use in worship as a part of the ministry of the word. And that brings me to the first point I'd like to make in this presentation. I know I'm going to stick my neck out. Some of you will be waiting for me after this presentation. I'll be hard to find. The arts are not ancillary to preaching. They are integral. The arts are not supplementary to preaching, but vital. All right, now sure, the inspired written word and the preached word are always first and foremost. But we may be missing something by always making the arts supplementary. In a sermon for Reformation Sunday, delivered well over 30 years ago, Martin Franzmann began with this intriguing affirmation. I gave it to you on your outline. Theology is doxology. Theology must sing. The church with psalms must shout. No door can keep them, that is, the psalms, out. Hymns for Franzmann were theology. They carried a word. They carried the word of God. The best of them, Franzmann wrote, teach and admonish as word. Not just because they support the word, you understand, because they are the word. Hymns preach. The best hymns teach. Hymns bring together theology and doxology. I would maintain that what is true of hymns also rings true of the visual arts, drama, and poetry. It is the davar of both word and event. Some would say that davar is a word that creates an event. So if someone in the back of the room yells fire, an event is created. The Hebrew davar says something more. Here the word is the event. It is the event. In one word in Hebrew, God says, let there be light. And word and event in that moment in time are one. So word as event, an event in time, moving, shaping, expressing, verbing, calling into being, all of that points in the direction of saying the word and the arts are inseparable partners, just as theology and doxology are inexorably linked. So when Jeremiah strolls down to the pottery shop on an assignment from God, that is word and event as one. When he buries his underwear and then digs it up again, that is word and event. Okay, it's a loincloth. It's word and event as one. Or when Isaiah walks stripped and barefoot for 3 years among his people, that's word and event as one. None of those, by the way, am I suggesting that you bring into your own personal preaching. But word and event are joined. Theology and art become one. Was it just the words that were the word, or was the visit to the pottery shop and what happened there the word as well? Let me say this another way. The word brings into being images, drama, tensions, movement, narrative, and that's the arts. Where the word is, the arts are there. So I will not accept the notion that somehow the arts are only ancillary, supplementary to some stagnant, vacuumized word that may be delivered with no passion, no color, heaven forbid, no image, no movement, no drama. French Dominican M.D. Chenu speaks even more strongly. The greatest tragedy of theology in the past 3 centuries, he writes, has been the divorce of the theologian from the poet, the dancer, the musician, the painter, the dramatist, the actress, and the movie maker. They knew it in the early church, and it survived in the church even into the Middle Ages. We have somebody of all people, 12th century, Bernard of Clairvaux, gives us this verse. Jesus, the dancer's master, is a great skill in the dance is his. He turns to the right, he turns to the left. All must follow his teaching deft. Theology and the arts are one. Now, what's more, now listen, because this is perhaps going to run against your grain as well. What's more, the arts are inseparable from the task of preaching. When we prepare our sermons, when we deliver our sermons, we are artists. Listen, we are artists more than essayists. We are artists more than therapists. We are artists more than politicians, more than logicians. We are first and foremost theologians, but since what we have to say about God is most important, that's the way it should be. But as soon as you craft a sentence, no, as soon as you choose just the right word to say what you're trying to say, it's art. And art and preaching merge. This is true in a number of senses. First, for many today, poetry comes to mind when they think of preaching. I don't want to step on some of the toes of some of our presenters coming tomorrow, but think of that a lot's being written these days about you as a preacher being a poet. 10 years ago, Walter Brueggemann wrote eloquently in his book, Finally Comes the Poet, that preaching in a world, as he puts it, flattened by prose, must become poetry. Brueggemann's prose world and ours is a day-by-day, take-for-granted world, living at the edge of despair, conformity, resignation. It's a settled, ruddified world in which it's all prose and it's all the same. And Brueggemann suggests that preachers need to speak a better word, a different word, a word that stands out, a word that sounds a bit like a poet and a prophet, all tied together into one, a word that transforms and transports, a word that pictures, a word that carries hope and change that curses the prince of darkness. You need to read Brueggemann's book, Finally Comes the Poet. It's sort of out of context, but he's leaning on Walt Whitman's verse, after the seas are all crossed as they seem already crossed, after the great captains and engineers have accomplished their work, after the noble inventors, after the scientists, the chemists, the geologists, ethnologists, finally shall come the poet. Worthy that name, the true Son of God shall come singing his songs. And you, friends, are that poet. You are that one called to speak the poetry of God in a world flattened with prose. A different word, a better word, a word that stands out. And you do it from the pulpit, a different language, the language of transformation. In Eugene Peterson's Subversive Spirituality, you'll find a quote from W.H. Auden, which I've given you on your outlines. It's picked up by Eugene Peterson to characterize the poetic quality of John's revelation. He really sees John as poet, as image maker. I find the Auden citation immensely helpful when I apply it to my own preaching. In 1973, not long before Auden died, he wrote that we demand two things of a poem. And tell me this doesn't sound like preaching. Firstly, it must be a well-made verbal object that does honor to the language in which it is written. Secondly, it must say something significant about a reality common to us all, but proceed from a unique perspective. Now, there's a motherload of freight there for us preachers. When we preach, we do honor to the language, as Auden says, not just to English or to Spanish, but to the original languages of the scriptures. We do honor to the language of faith. We do honor to the language of the scriptures, to the language of our tradition as Lutherans, to our theology. And hopefully, in every sermon you preach, you have something significant to say. That would be good. About reality common to us all, that the subjects you deal with in law and gospel probe to the depths of law, to the ultimates, something that deals with those realities that cut across humanity, but perceived, as Auden writes, from a unique perspective, from our perspective that is one of judgment and grace. And it goes deeper, too. Increasingly, we're beginning to see that the work of the preacher is the work of the dramatist, and as we heard earlier, of the storyteller. You know, for as long as we Lutherans have been preaching with the tension of law and gospel, we have been busy with the stuff of drama and maybe didn't even know it. We've been busy with the tension and the conflict that comes with law gospel. We've been telling stories that have a beginning and a middle and an end. Our sermons themselves were those stories. Gene Lowry's narrative plot, which many of the students here at the seminary have come to know and maybe love, his plot form suggests that when we preach, we can do a narrative sermon and never once even tell a story, but our sermon has the structure of a story. So we begin with a conflict. The conflict gets complicated. There's a sudden shift. We heard about that this morning. And out of that sudden shift, there's an unfolding of resolution. You preachers, many of you may not even know it, but you've been doing the stuff of the arts, drama, and storytelling just in the way that you preach law gospel. Even a second-year seminarian, imagine that, a second-year seminarian can look at Lowry's loop and say, it looks an awful lot like law gospel to me, but maybe has a little bit more going for it. And that's the truth. But it goes even deeper. When we preachers paint pictures with our words, we're also artists and we're musicians. On the music side, those of us who are so taken these days by the traditional African-American preaching tradition, we notice that they preach with a musicality, that traditional African-American preachers begin low and go high and end up with everyone on their feet in a mode of praise. There's a musicality to their voice. There's what's called a hum, a riff, an almost liturgical call and response between preacher and people. They talk about feedback, and they mean feedback. People actually speaking to them and urging them on. We others, many of us white guys in pleated pants, are more comfortable with feelback. Just show me you're there. Show something on your face that says, you notice me. But this wonderful musical quality that goes with preaching in the African American tradition is something you and I need to be in touch with, because we can learn much from an oral culture that for decades, more than that, was not allowed to read books. And so they have learned how to truly speak the word in a sense that makes it rich in oral excellence. Once in a while, we might even envy that tradition enough to try it ourselves. Frankly, it doesn't always work very well. But the closest I ever got was in telling a story in one of my sermons in Minnesota, where I suddenly began singing Beautiful Savior. And to my surprise, the whole congregation joined in singing that with me. And I had no idea what to do when they did it, because I don't know how to lead singing a cappella. And when they were finished with the first verse, they sang the second verse as well. And I think they thought I was going to sit down and finish the sermon, or that it was already finished. But later that week, someone who had visited us asked if we did that every Sunday. And I said, no, but I remember loving it, how there was a spontaneity to the listeners that brought music and art to preaching. To preach is to reach out with the arts. Like poets, we make something when we preach. Poetes means making. This may not surprise you. You do not make anything out of nothing. I know you look at empty sheets of paper and blank computer screens. I know you know what an ex nihilo mood is like when you're preparing your sermons. But only God creates out of nothing. When we create, we tap creation. Jürgen Moltmann reminds us that in using creation in our sermons, we are using a fallen order and tainted images at best. That should humble us all. The stuff with which we deal is not good stuff all the way through. Yet in this fallen world and from this fallen world, you and I find the stuff of sermons. We conceive. And when the baby is conceived, so to speak, there's still the matter of delivery. There's living in the language, finding a structure, seeing the word, feeling the word, being moved within the text, letting the text have its way with us, and finally preaching that text in a way that honors its moods and transitions along the way. And all of that is art. I know some of you out there would rather hear me say that preaching is the work of teachers, of leaders, of shepherds, of dogmaticians, of coaches, of vision casters, of stewards, of builders, of growers, but today you're an artist. And that's a good thing to be. So far we've said that the arts are not ancillary but integral to the task of theology and to the task of preaching. And the preacher, after all, ends up being an artist. That brings us now to a look at the arts as the point of intersection between theology and culture. One obvious function of the arts in preaching is simply to interest. Big surprise. C.S. Lewis writes, "To interest is the first duty of art. No other excellences will ever begin to compensate for failure in this, and very serious faults will be covered by this as by charity." Some presentations of the arts, as with some sermons, can be as boring as ever, and when they are, they fail at their first duty, which is to interest. Perhaps this ability to pique interest was captured so well, and this will surprise you that I'm referencing this, but an old film from 1965, La Dolce Vita, does anybody remember it? We had permission to show you the opening clip that I was going to show, but I decided not to do it, if anybody remembers that. But it's a helicopter with in Italy, and the helicopter is transporting a large, bigger-than-life statue of Christ, reminiscent of my church sanctuary. Christ is actually suspended from the helicopter, and the helicopter is swooping over anybody remember this? As this Christ figure swoops over this farmer's field, he gets off his tractor in an Italian. He says, hi, Jesus, I don't know what the Italian is, and then moves on across several tourists. And then the helicopter goes by the beach with several scantily clad women in their bikinis. That's why we didn't show the clip, although there'll be a private showing later. I didn't say that. We're not doing that. But what's neat is that the helicopter suddenly circles back and goes back over the beach again as And all these women are waving to this. And it's a tremendous scene, actually, on what in the world does the culture do with Jesus? And it really gets your interest. I mean, you're into the movie right away. But it's a clip I'll never forget because it does capture this sense of what shall we do with Jesus. Sort of reminds me of the LCMS balloon, if you know what I mean. In the church that I left a couple years ago, the idea of piquing interest through the arts, and I sure want to commend this to you. We had a practice, and I just saw, and Jerry Coleman is the senior pastor there now. They're having a Christian art festival that's going on right now. But we would invite artists from around the country to enter their works. Jurors from art faculties of local colleges and universities would jury the festival. We'd get about 150 entries, and we'd hang 60 pieces of art in the sanctuary. And some of my fondest memories are the fact that people came to our church for that art festival. Their interest was piqued because they loved the arts, and that brought them there who otherwise would not have come to the church. And some of my greatest memories in worship are preaching parts of sermons next to pieces of art that were hung in that sanctuary or sculpture displayed. Prayers were spoken next to various pieces. The church was always packed. To interest is the first duty of art. A second function comes as art helps us to reveal what's bad about us, what's bad about the culture. Second use, sermonic expose, exposing the culture, exposing ourselves for what we're like. It's no accident, it seems to me, that we'll be hearing more quotes from Death of a Salesman over these next months because of the bringing it back to Broadway, and it's such a hit right now again. But boy, if you ever want an expose on what can go wrong with one's identity and meaning and integrity, that certainly does it. We can discuss the disdain postmodern culture has for a fixed identity and tradition, but somehow it gets crystallized for us when we hear a punk rocker sing this lyric, "I belong to the blank generation. I have no beliefs. I belong to no community, tradition, or anything like that." Sure sounds different when you read it, doesn't it? "I'm lost in this vast, vast world. I belong nowhere. I have absolutely no identity." Or what does it do to talk about how one can slowly cook like a frog in a beaker? We can lose our faith, our life in Christ. What does it do to talk about that without referencing, for instance, John Updike's 1996 book, In the Beauty of the Lilies? In that book, if you've not read it, you really need to. It traces the life of a family through this century now ending. And along the way, the different generations, it also discusses the movies that we're currently playing. But the patriarch of the family is a pastor who loses his faith in the midst of doing his pastoral duties. Gradually, tragically, throughout the book, we watch a family and its changing relationship with God. And somehow it helps us get a grip on just what is it like to lose one's faith. A third function of the arts in preaching comes with the power of the arts as image or metaphor, similes, synecdoche. I think of E.E. Cummings' little poem, "I Am a Little Church." We can preach on humility, but doesn't this do it better? "I am a little church, no great cathedral. Winter by spring, I lift my diminutive spire to him who's only now is forever." That says it so much better. Or who can look at the closing scene of Steven Spielberg's film Schindler's List? We were going to show you a clip of that. They wouldn't give us permission. They don't like showing the end of the film without the complete film being shown. They wouldn't give me enough time for the complete film Schindler's List to be shown. But remember at the end of the film where Schindler's with his assistant, they've worked so hard to save hundreds, even thousands of lives by having them work in factories. And Schindler says to his aide as he's leaving, "I should have saved more. I could have saved more." And he looks at his car, he looks at what he's wearing, and he said, "This is a person. This car is three people. I could have saved them," because they literally bought people out of the camps to work in the factory bribing others. I can't look at that without sensing the regrets that I have already of missed opportunities to share the gospel with others, and the church's missing of opportunities and mission toward others. Or the film The Truman Show, where a man's life ends up being a show. Itself is a metaphor for our inability these days to distinguish what's real, what's true and authentic. You think those two boys at Columbine High School Did they understand what was real and what wasn't? Our culture is having a bad time doing that. The Truman Show shows it so well. Truman's wife, his best friend, his neighbors, they're all actors. It's all a show. It's a big soundstage. Everybody knows it, except Truman. And it's a telling film on what the culture is like. A fourth function of the arts in preaching comes, as surprisingly we may find, in the arts images that actually carry the gospel or share biblical truth with our people. I mean this, if you look hard enough, if you're reading good material, you'll find material that honestly communicates beautifully the values and the message of the word. When I would preach wedding sermons, more than once I'd go back to Thornton Wilder's play, The Skin of Our Teeth. There, Mrs. Antrobos, an intriguing figure if you remember the play, Mrs. Antrobos looks at her husband, and they're not getting along very well, but she has the wisdom to say this. She says, "I didn't marry you because you're perfect. I married you because you gave me a promise. And your promise has made up for all of your faults." She takes off her wedding ring and sticks it in his face and says, "And my promise has made up for all of my faults." And you can't read that without sensing, yeah, marriage at its root is a matter of promise and commitment, no matter what comes. And that brings us to a film clip we are going to share with you. It's one of my favorite from recent years. I'm watching our clock a little bit. I'd like you to look at a clip from Amistad. How many of you have seen Amistad? Good, so you'll recognize it. Remember the scene where they're waiting, the next day will be the first decision on what's going to happen to these slaves who rebel on a slave ship and actually capture the ship but are tricked into bringing it back to the United States instead of going back to Africa. And so they're in the United States, and the judge needs to make a decision. Are they cargo? Are they to be slaves? Or will they be allowed to be sent home? While they're in prison, some abolitionists have given one of the slaves a Bible. They are illiterate. They have never, ever in their lives encountered the gospel. All they have in their hands is a Bible with pictures. And as I thought about coming to you with preaching in the arts and the power of image, this scene came to mind. Now, what you're going to see initially will be one of the highlight scenes of Amistad is where the protagonist, the leader of the slaves, shouts out in the courtroom, "Give us free." He's learned something close to some English, and he's asking for his freedom. But then we're going to go to the prison and watch these two slaves begin to discover — they weren't slaves, they ended up being declared free — begin to discover what Jesus is about. They don't get it all right, but they're on their way. All right, so let's take a look at this. Jim, please.
"Perhaps I may need a quill and parchment and a better imagination."
"And what poundage do you imagine the entry may refer to, sir? A mast and sails, perhaps?"
"Give us free. Give us free." "Give us free."
"Your Honor, please instruct the defendant that he cannot disrupt these proceedings with such a..."
"Give us free!
If we are to have any semblance of order in this court, Your Honor..."
"Give us free!
Keep crying out, 'Give us free,' or anything else
that... Give us free!
I am trying to question this witness!
Give us free! Give us free!"
pie pitonga be pilonila. Ya kwemi ya kipiloma.
Gi de gulama. Ya koma.
Danunga to morning go away. In day be o tailo, jittingy lane.
Yemia go ke follow a togima in that be. Ja maanunga tabau. Ati mavele. Tadenga avingiwe. Ya boyeya. Kehinda uya. Tingi huwa dema we. Tingi ili bi.
Nyamuge.
Be. Omu avoy. Bom pieni nagbi pie tingi wa lofa ilongo bito se atingi wa
yanda teno aki
tole yagboyele. Tingi wome Boelo. Boejima.
Confiteor de omnipotenti, beate Maria sempre vergine.
Tliangie. Qui
unto Michele Arcangelo.
Ti bembe cole hum siamo a pie.
Beato Ioanni Baptiste.
Tatuae ha.
Sancti
sapiens omnibus sanctis. Boelo.
Et vobis
fra. Nunga ayama.
Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa.
Tiepe.
Ego Arcangelo, beato mio anno Battista, sanctus apostolus Petrum et Paulo, omnes sanctus et vos fratres, orare pro me ad Domino Deum nostro, confiteor de omnibus.
Mimia,
beate Maria,
pia fea lina,
beato mio Arcangelo, beato Ioanni Baptiste, sanctus apostolus
Timua.
Petrum et Paulo, omnibus
sanctus. Nyamunyo. Nyamunyo.
to DreamWorks Productions, which gave us permission to show that. I can think of a few pieces of film in recent years that have been so bold in giving that much time to pictures of our faith and to understanding the power of the image in terms of communicating the faith as well. That's a precious piece of film. I don't know if you counted, but we've got about 6 minutes of pictures of our faith in front of people, and we can thank Steven Spielberg for this boldness he has with matters of faith in his films. Some thoughts on the role of the arts in reaching the baptized and the unbaptized. Clearly and perhaps most obviously, if you're going to bring the arts into your preaching, you need to be reading. You need to be reading alongside your preaching. I know for you seminarian students, yeah, right. You're just trying to keep up with the assignments you have while you're here, but at least when you get out of here, you really need to be reading things like Updike's In the Beauty of the Lilies, things like John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany. I don't know if you've read that or not, but it begins with these lines. This will make you want to read it. These are the opening lines of Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany. I am doomed to remember a boy with a wrecked voice, not because of his voice or because he was the smallest person I ever knew, or even because he was the instrument of my mother's death, but because he is the reason I believe in God. I am a Christian because of Owen Meany. Those are the opening lines. I think a few of you might buy that book and read it with that little tease. Or J.F. Powers' Wheat That Springeth Green, a story about a priest in a suburban parish who discovers his true vocation while he's there. Anything that Annie Dillard wrote is probably worth reading. Tinker Creek, An American Childhood, Holy the Firm. Just as important is it that we keep seeing films, films that we think are going to have some content worthy of bringing into our sermons. When it comes to being poet and artist in preaching, it's no secret that artistic gifts vary among us. Some of you are immensely gifted to be able to sit down and write a one-story narrative sermon. Others of you probably shouldn't try it. I'd like you to try it. I know that Dr. Jensen would like you to try it. But I know that there are different capacities for that sort of writing. For some of you, it will still be a matter, unfortunately, in some way, of always distilling a text instead of fulfilling it, distilling it down to two, usually three, points that you want to share. Many of us, though, maybe most of us, have the gifts it takes to sit down and truly work at crafting the language we use. I love Suzanne Harvey's words about how hard it is to write well, especially when you're writing oral composition, not for literary purposes, not an essay, but to be spoken. Every word's dipped in blood, she writes, marinated with sweat. You enshrine a semicolon, canonize a verb, beautify some errant phrase. When the seconds stretch like rubber bands, then snap, boomerang, and ricochet, hurling you back onto a blank page. Every sentence is stretched in acid. We chisel them from the marrow of our bones. It's hard work to do art. And if we strive for excellence in our preaching, it seems to me we should also strive for excellence in all of the arts. Again, gifts vary from church to church, from pastor to pastor. Much of the distaste, in my opinion, expressed toward drama in worship in our church body is because it's done so poorly. Much of the distaste expressed in our church body toward contemporary Christian worship music is because that often is done so poorly. The church, frankly, can no longer get away with the people outside of it and with the people inside, get away with bathrobes and tennis shoes for drama costuming. Nor will people endure a junior high clarinetist accompanied by a guitarist who just started lessons for our contemporary service. I have seen far too many Lenten soliloquies read in monotone pitch, peppered with anachronisms and clearly presented by somebody who'd rather be getting his molars pulled than doing what pastor has asked him to do on Wednesday night. The content and the presentation of the arts in worship relative to preaching needs to reach the highest level of excellence a given congregation can attain. For many of us, it means the other arts should reach the same level as our choral program, our choir. For some of you, that perhaps is not true. The standard is not right. I'm especially interested, as you know, in the role that drama can play in helping us in our worship. I have found in my own preaching ministry that drama is a wonderful partner. It was commonplace for me in the parish to stop in the middle of a sermon and say, "What does this look like in real life?" And the drama troupe would come out and do their 2 to 3 minute drama, and I'd pick it up from there, maybe even stroll among the characters in the drama and talk about how this relates to the text. Drama can provide a straightforward saying or even gospel pronouncement. It can offer character analysis that shapes your sermon. It can present a story that parallels the story of the text and so gives you your sermon all wrapped inside of it. The drama should never take the place of the sermon, but it certainly is a great partner to the word. And now, as I'm looking at the clock, we might have time to actually pull off a surprise here. This is for my entertainment almost more than yours, because I'm anxious to see how this turns out. I've been looking at you, and some of you, I've written your names down. We're going to ask you to come forward. Unbeknownst to you, we're going to do a drama. And this is how I'm going to close my presentation. So as I call your name out, whether you want to or not, would you please come forward? These are people that were my friends and... Let me just say, I really have enjoyed our friendship very much. If you're here, please stand up and come forward. Mike Burdick, are you here, Mike? Oh, he's up in the balcony. Joe Cox, one of our vicars, he's been in our theater program here. Here comes Joe. Jerry Coleman, pastor of a great church in Minnesota. Bo Baumeister, where's Bo? Bo here? There he is. He's trying to hide. And I think we have one more here, too. Paul Wiebolt, are you here? Paul Wiebolt? Oh, would you come up, please? Okay, guys, if you'll come. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's Mike. All right. This is over the lunch hour, I did this. I just did a little quick drama on this last Sunday's gospel. The text is, Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going, so how can we know the way?" And the title of this is, "Do You Know the Way?" And we'll have Mike, you will be number one. You have the lead, congratulations. Joe Cox, number two. Bo, number three. And where are we at here? Paul, you've got, you'd be number four, wouldn't you? Number four. And finally, Jerry, you're number five. You're the good guy. Okay? All right, now we're going to quick do a rehearsal. Guys, come on stage. All right, those of you who are, number one, you're looking for the way, okay? So you're going to keep standing in front of here. Guys, you're going to line up, start with one over here, and go down to, or two over here, I'm sorry, and five over here. Turn your back that way. When he taps your shoulder, come up and talk to him here at the mic, okay? So 2, 3, 4, 5. You got it, and you just tap the shoulder, come up to the microphone so you can be heard, and we're on our way. This is titled, Do You Know the Way? And this is something that could be used, if you use creative worship or any of that, you know, it could be used as part of your preaching ministry. I really enjoy watching you up there, Mike.
Thank you,
Dean. Go
ahead.
Excuse me. Do you know the way to Zion Lutheran Church, please?
Why, as a matter of fact, I do. I'm a member. Why do you want to know how to get to our church?
Why do I want to know?
Yes. You must have some reason to want directions.
Well, I want to go there.
For?
Well, for prayer, for worship, for the word, for what you usually do in church.
I see. Are you a fellow member?
Well, no. If I was a member, would I be asking for directions to the church? Well, okay, I suppose some inactive members.
Let me take down your name and address and your phone number, and I'll have someone contact you.
With directions?
No, with a questionnaire.
Let me get this straight. Before you'll give me directions to Zion Lutheran Church, I have to fill out a questionnaire.
Right. Can't be too careful these days with strangers wanting to get into our church.
Then never mind.
Pardon me.
Pardon me, I need directions to Zion Lutheran Church.
You're a guy, and you're asking for directions?
Well, yes.
Where's your manhood, buddy? Didn't anybody tell you we guys don't ask for directions? We play Lewis and Clark. It's a guy thing. A testosterone thing. We look and look and wait for our wives to say, "Honey, this just doesn't seem right." Then we keep driving. It drives them crazy.
But my wife isn't even...
Hey, don't ask for directions. It doesn't look good. Makes you look like a sissy. Asking for help. Get out there and wander, guy. Wander. Be a man. Blaze a trail. Every destination has a price, right? Go for it.
Thanks.
You betcha. Now get out there and go for it.
Say, may I bother you for just a moment, please?
Certainly. What do you need?
Well, believe it or not, I need directions to Zion Lutheran Church. You know the place?
Like the back of my hand. What a place. The music, the ambiance, the appointments, the people. It's all so fantastic.
Oh, great. So how do I get there?
All roads lead there.
To Zion Lutheran Church?
Exactly.
So, can you give me one of those roads?
That will have to be your choice. It makes no difference. You'll end up there soon enough. After all, it's the journey that counts, not how you get there.
Okay.
The important thing is that it works for you.
Works?
That it feels good. That it fits.
You're not gonna tell me, are you?
That would be presumptuous of me, wouldn't it?
I suppose. Would you happen to know how to get to Zion Lutheran Church?
I do.
How?
You're looking at it.
What do you mean?
I am your way, okay?
You know the way?
I do, and I will take you there.
It's that simple?
That simple. Ready?
Let's go.
Yeah, you get a copy. They get a copy, right? Thanks. I had no idea those guys had that talent. My goodness. Well, I need to close, and I'm going to do that. I'm often brought back when I think about the arts to that wonderful closing line of your favorite high school play, Our Town. Remember Emily, the day she gets to relive after dying? Doesn't happen, but it does in the play. And it's so rich and so fantastic. She asks the question of the stage manager, does anybody realize life while they're living it? Remember the stage manager says, not really, except maybe the poets and the saints. This has been a presentation that says when we preach, we're both. We're poets and we're saints. And we bring to life in our preaching the life of one who died but has risen. And to borrow a metaphor from the arts, for his sake, for that one, let's pull out all the stops as we preach. Thank you very much.